Okay, so the sutta we're doing today is number 19 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, two kinds of thought. So what I'll do, I'll just go through a couple of sections at a time, and I'll just stop and check, and if you have any views and opinions, you can just speak up. I'll let you people speak before I do, because otherwise there may be nothing left. I don't want to rip you off too much. Okay. So, thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Ananda Pindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. As I abided thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered, this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered, this lead to others' affliction, it decided in me. When I considered, this leads to the affliction of both, it decided in me. So when I considered, this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So you can see, during the 6 years of the Buddha striving before he actually attained to the four enlightenment stages in quite quick succession, the 6 years of striving that he had, but you know, he's still that had the underlying awareness that even though he actually hadn't realized the fruits, the actual path and fruition moment in relation to the enlightenment experiences, that the awareness is there, that those underlying defilements of the mind, had virtually the potential to obstruct and block the path. And for the vast majority of us, that's what we're actually working with. Especially with the monks, we tend to put more emphasis on the kind of terminology, the kind of attitude we have. But like with the lay disciples, we don't sort of speak in terms of a person's personality, like being a mass of, say, defilements or kilesa. It's an impersonal viewpoint on a person living in society, because the vast majority of us, or say the majority of people outside the monastic form, even though we're Buddhist people, and we have this understanding that we have to work through the mind, we have to work with the underlying forces and energies, and essentially we have to quell the passions, quell the anger, the hatred and aversion, bring the mind to deep peace, and then investigate very thoroughly on the level of vipassana, because you've got to have samadhi as a at least say upachara samadhi is a minimum basis if you're really serious about attaining to the path. Otherwise, the mind just does not have any real power, clarity, energy. The defilements are just so incredibly sticky, and they very, very subtle. And as the longer a person actually spends developing, the longer period of time the person spends developing the practice, usually that you find the harder they have to work in a general sense Because what we're the defilements that are actually working with those underlying forces and energies, which have the potential to block the path, are more subtle. They're a little bit more, you know, definitely more tricky to work with. And one thing you do see is the when we speak in terms of actually thought, you know, thought is. You know, I've heard a number. I mean, the Buddha said this, but you know, you're coming from a very high level. I've heard senior teachers. Refer to this in this manner, that the mind states, or say like thoughts being obstructions to you know, developing the path to a deep level. But it's, you know, essentially it's a person's feelings. It's the feelings of sensuality, the feelings of say love, greed, hatred, anger, irritation, jealousy. You know, that's the major area which blocks people. And you know, just a thought, thought in itself, without an emotional content, doesn't have a lot of power over your mind, but emotions do. And we all know examples of people who go through very, say, passionate episodes, and potentially they've killed a person, they've committed an armed robbery, or they've done all sorts of things which may not necessarily have been in their character, but when the conditions, you know, when they were under pressure, or, you know, their partner left them, or something went wrong in a major way, they just completely flipped and lost it. So, so it's the, you know, for myself, I tend to put more emphasis on people's emotional framework when it comes to Dhamma and practice, and even like with meditation. You know, human beings, they're emotional beings, and that's the major thing you're working on. Because, you know, so for example, you're able to refine your mind to the point where you had incredibly very, very slight, subtle feelings of both greed and, you know, hatred, delusion, of the three categories, you know, at an incredibly refined level. It wouldn't be such a major problem for you to actually, you know, drop your mind into fairly decent samadhi. You know, it's those thoughts at that level, those thoughts would be a pushover for a meditator with, say, like medium, you know, definitely beyond the beginner's level, but like medium experience onwards. You know, they could shut that mind down quite quickly. So four to five. the last paragraph section. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me, a thought of cruelty arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of cruelty has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus, it has subsided in me. Never a thought of cruelty arose in me. I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his or her mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and then their mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty, they have abandoned the thought of non-cruelty to cultivate the thought of cruelty, and then their mind inclines to thoughts of cruelty. What you're looking there, it's quite just common sense stuff that the actual, when you look at the conditioning process inside the mind. That the whole process of the mind body experience of a human being is a conditioned process that runs on cause and effect. And so if we incline our mind in a certain direction, we move the mind in certain ways, to particular objects, people, circumstances, even ideas, fantasy, whatnot, you know, it becomes a habit pattern. It actually increases the force and the energy of those underlying, say, obstructions. And, you know, it's not difficult to comprehend, but this principle of the conditioning process of the mind, you know, that's really a point which stands out quite significantly. But also, within the process of meditation, that's what we're doing as well. We are reconditioning our mind and the qualities of our mind in order to develop wholesome states and basically undermine and reduce those potentially harmful defilements which are on deeper levels in the mind. And naturally, this is the, you know, for on an experiential level with people on the path, you know, they do feel a degree of like friction. You know, there's always, whenever you oppose the defilements, whenever you oppose greed and anger, you know, it's you can feel the resistance there. And these defilements, you know, they've been with us for like absolutely hundreds, you know, hundreds of thousands of lifetimes, you know, as a small figure, as the, you know, the Buddha said, you know, the process of samsara is beginningless. You can't find a starting point to this this cycle of beings actually being born and actually dying from life to life in this cycle of rebirth. So these defilements have an incredible amount of power, and they are not to be underestimated. But it is a tricky scenario, you know, working with one's underlying energies. And for myself, I never recommend people to use the sledgehammer approach, because for most people it doesn't work. You know, if you put too much pressure on the mind, you know, you especially look, say, like on meditation retreat, if you're like incredibly strict, you're doing too many hours, you know, you will bring up very, very strong defilements will arise in the mind, and that can be actually quite disturbing and almost like unconducive for some people. And they can really spoil their practice if they virtually force their Dhamma practice, because like intrinsically you want an experience where you maximize the peacefulness that you're actually developing in the practice. You maximize the level of, say, peacefulness, the positivity, and those, you know, underlying those wholesome states, you know, based in the three main areas. And then when you've reached that, say, that rough point of balance and equilibrium, then you maintain that over years, over 10, 20 years, because it's, you know, because realistically, the people who get the best results with Dhamma practice, they are the people who keep themselves in line with the middle path. They know exactly how much effort to, you know, when to strive, when to relax, you know, what tools to use at different times, you know, how much force to use with particular mind states, or, you know, the kind of their approach, you know, in a general sense, which relates to, say, skillfulness, a level of you know, being skillful with the tools that you have, the knowledge that you have developed over the years. Okay, so paragraph 7. Just as in the last months of the rainy season in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cow herd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because they see that they could be flogged, imprisoned, fined or blamed if they let them stray into the crops. So too I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. Which a point which just came up in my mind then. This is a bit of a funny point, but it just came up, was this business person sees in unwholesome states danger, degradation and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So that's something, this is something that that can actually occur, say, in people who, say, expose themselves to pornography on a regular basis, that, you know, even though they might find it very interesting and enjoyable and whatnot, that essentially it really, it's quite disturbing. It really increases the, say, the force of lust, perversion, and the underlying, say, strength of those defilements, and that sense of perversion that can be generated over time in that area can lead to all sorts of weird and sort of twisted and strange mind states. So point eight, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent and resolute, a sort of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this sort of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom. It does not cause difficulties and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quietened it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. Yeah, so this business here where the the Buddha chose to, you know, essentially to shut the thought process down so that his mind would not be disturbed. So naturally, in the mind of a Buddha who's a purified being, that the thoughts which actually arise in his mind, based in wholesomeness, you know, wholesome, intention, motives, and whatnot. And but even for a person who has a mind of such incredible refinement and subtlety, that just the normal, say, thinking process, a normal, mode of investigation is actually an irritation to a person who, what's the right words? Who actually thinks and investigates virtually along any line. So even though the mind's pure, the defilements do not exist in that mind, that just a simple process of investigation and pondering can be, you know, irritating, disturbing. And when you have the choice, you know, you will abide in deep states of tranquility. You know, especially the Buddha, Buddhas who have mastery of samadhi, many of the Kribrachans who are incredibly proficient, at least up to the fourth jhana. There's the number of people proficient in fourth jhana as arahants is greater than those who are proficient in all eight, all the eight jhanas, and Nirodha Samapatti. So, you know, the people who have the full range, you know, who can actually drop the mind, you know, into, say, cessation, into the state of nibbana, you know, cessation of feeling, perception. They are less so than the former category. So point 9 to 10. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of none evil arose in me, a thought of none cruelty arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of none cruelty has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quietened it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of non-ill will, upon thoughts of non-cruelty, they have abandoned the thought of cruelty to cultivate the thought of non-cruelty, and then their mind inclines to thoughts of non-cruelty. And the point, a thought which just came up was in relation with, say, Carnet prison, where many of those guys there. They've been imprisoned by, you know, through breaking the say the moral code, the social moral code that we have in our communities and society as a whole. You know, say like in Australian culture. And many of these guys committed their crimes in virtually like states of passion, states of greed, desperation, like anger. You know, things like robbery, especially robberies in relation to drug dependency, things like sexual violence, you know, molestation, this kind of thing, child abuse, in relation to, to passion and basically perversion of the mind in that area. So you virtually, for people who've committed crimes and then they end up in the prison system, it's, you see this an intensification of the underlying defilements. The person, they may have been in a tricky situation, but they didn't put the brakes on, they didn't pull back and actually think about what they were doing, the repercussions. Many of these people, they just went with their defilements, they went with their desires. They may have killed somebody in a crime of passion, or they committed several bank robberies because they were so desperate for money, for heroin. And you're looking at these underlying forces at work, which are responsible for this kind of human behaviour. But the person doesn't have enough awareness, underlying awareness or wisdom, to actually catch themselves before they virtually cut loose and then do something really, really, unwholesome, which gets them into trouble with the law. So point 12. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, A cow herd would guard their cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open. Since they need only to be mindful that the cows are there, so too there was only need for me in order to be mindful that those states were there. Which reflects the level of vipassana and insight. Tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind concentrated and unified. So quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. I entered upon and abided in the first jhana. I directly knew. Yeah, but this principle here, I directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived. What has to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. So, you know, when the Buddha had that realization, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, that's when the person is actually withdrawn from samadhi. You know, you don't get that level of realization or any deep insight within the samadhi state, because the mind can't move. It's absolutely still, you know, it's completely unified, so it's impossible to even think. People who've got mastery of, say Kruparachans, or people who have mastery of samadhi, at least, say the first jhana, say is an absolute minimum, at like any time, anywhere. That is the kind of person who could actually investigate Dhamma at the intermediate range of Upachara Samadhi. But once you reach the upper scale of Upachara Samadhi, the mind, the mind has to shut down. It has to drop down to its base in tranquility. So, point 24. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the third watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. It's very, like, clear, very, very clear knowing. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. And so that's also been the life history of the vast majority of people, say, you know, including Ajahn Brahm, that those people who've attained to realization of Dhamma have put in, a real, absolute minimum, say, significant to incredible amount of spiritual work, at least in the current life, and usually in a couple of past lives, in order to break through to the path, you know, because it does take quite a lot of work, and not just effort, but, you know, like wise effort, you know, level of say, like skill, like constantly, you know, especially when you're moving from the intermediate to the advanced stage, you know, the qualities that you have are well beyond the range of, say, the average meditator. So suppose, bhikkhus, that in a wooded range there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared, desiring their ruin, harm and bondage, and he closed off the safe and good path that led to their happiness, and he opened up a false path, and he put out a decoy and set up a dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster and loss. But another man came desiring their good, welfare and protection, and he reopened the safe and good path that led to their happiness, and he closed off the false path, and he removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy, so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase and fulfillment. Bhikkhus, I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasures. And the Buddha uses this simile, you know, like, you know, this, like, sensual pleasures is a very, like, low, very low thing. But, you know, but when you've got incredible meditation, you know, you can say things like that. And the large herd of deer is a term for beings. The man desiring their ruin, harm and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. the personification of evil. The false path is a term for the wrong eightfold path, that is, wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration. And and you know, if you practice the path, you've practiced the path in an incorrect manner. It just gives rise to bad results. And if you're cluey enough, you will see that very early. So in a way, you can gauge that when you develop your practice. If you're, regardless of what you do, the approach, the meditation, the way you investigate and develop wisdom and whatnot, if you're giving rise to good results, to wholesome results, then you know you're on track. You know you're actually in line with what the Buddha taught and in line with like Dhamma principles. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. The dummy is a term for ignorance. The man desiring their good welfare and protection is a term for the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. The safe and good path that led to their happiness is a term for the noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So, bhikkhus, the safe and good path that leads to happiness has been reopened by me. The wrong path has been closed off, the decoy removed, the dummy destroyed. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them? That I have done for you, bhikkhus, and also for the lay disciples. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, did anybody have any points whatsoever? Okay, we'll finish up.